Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the High Tech Information Blocking Task Force. This is subgroup number two. We're going to dive right in today. I know we've got a full agenda and a lot to cover. So just a quick roll call. Andy Truscott.
Yeah.
Michael Adcock. Valerie Gray. Anil Jain.
I'm here.
Arian Malik.
Hello.
And Stephen Lane.
I am here.
Thank you. I will turn it over to our chairs, or at least to Andy.
Thanks very much. Hey, guys, it's Andy Truscott here. Mike was intending to be on, but something unavoidable cropped up. So I'm afraid you're stuck with me for the next 2 hours of your life. If you notice me speaking slightly slower and attempting to enunciate clearer than usual, it's for the benefit of whoever's doing the closed captioning. We have discerned that my voice becomes the square bracket indiscernible unsquare bracket frequently, so I'm going as slowly as possible. Okay, I'm going to hand over initially to Mark Nee, who's supporting our task force, just to give an overview of what we're going to work through today, and then he'll come back to me and I'll talk through how we're going to go about recording all this.
Mark. Yeah, thanks, Andy. Thanks very much. So welcome, everyone, to Work Group 2, Exceptions. I think this should be a really interesting conversation. Just wanted to go over real quickly kind of the structure of the work group and what we're going to be discussing today. I think you should be able to see on your screen. I'm sharing my screen right now. We're working off the document that was circulated that provides the regulatory text for the various exceptions and that we're going to be talking about, as well as the preamble language for the request for comment, which we'll talk about as well. I want to emphasize, I know this came up in the full task force call, but I'll just say it again, that while I put the regulatory text in this document because it's, you know, that's like the language that we use, you know, it's the clearest way to talk about it. The preamble is really important because it provides examples and color and explanation as to why ONC made certain proposals and how we got to where we are. So I just want to emphasize that as we go through, even though I have the reg language up there, you know, we'll definitely be citing back to the preamble, which is very important as well. In the document, it's pretty straightforward. We just go through the seven exceptions, and you'll have an opportunity with the Google Doc, which if anyone needs the link, doesn't have it, we can send it back out, or I think they can post it, SL can post it. So you can open it up on your screen, and in real time, you can make edits, and it'll show on my screen, which I'm sharing, as Andy's doing right now. So today, you know, we're going to try to get through the first three exceptions, the exception for preventing harm, the exception for promoting the privacy of EHI, and the exception for promoting the security of EHI. It's a lot to cover, and as Andy and I have been doing with the other work groups, we're going to try to kind of get through all this, but of course we're going to circle back and talk about the issues that are still outstanding. We're definitely not going to get everything resolved today. And we're also going to bring the highest level issues to the full task force meeting this Friday for the full discussion. So that's the general structure. Let me just scroll down. Once we get through the exceptions, this work group also, they're pretty long, but this work group also has some requests for information about additional exceptions and the complaint process, as well as disincentives for healthcare providers. Because as you probably know in CURES, there's penalties laid out for health IT developers, exchanges, and networks, but disincentives for healthcare providers is still an open question. And we have a request for information out on that. So that's a real high-level overview. You know, I'm here to try to help out as much as possible to help you understand what ONC put into the information blocking section of the rule, why we did it. You know, I'm limited to what we put in the preamble and reg text, but I'll try to help as much as possible in citing to the language in the rule that will help us move the conversation along. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Andy and look forward to the conversation.
Thanks, Mark. So, hey, everybody, I'm going to assume that you've all got access to the Google Doc. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Anyone say no? Great. Okay. So, in the way that we've worked this with other work groups, we've actually been working through the Google Doc together in order and actually jointly collaborating and annotating in the comments and recommendations as we go. But we do that as a team. So anybody and everybody should be contributing into that. And as we discuss and dismiss or discuss and agree, that's where we're going to capture those dismissals or agreements. Does that make sense?
When you say we do that as a team, are you suggesting you would rather that we not work on this independently between our work group meetings?
I would rather that you worked on, if you work on this independently between work group meetings, you do so on the Google Docs version.
Right. No, that's what I mean.
Right.
But that's acceptable.
Absolutely. It's, I think it's going to be required for us to get through this.
Oh,
well.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks for the seeking the clarity. But what I don't want is everyone to work on their own versions on their own hard drives, which then take a whole bunch of sifting through, and we end up having to discuss all the discrepancies between them. Do it in one place. Make sense?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, so without further ado, we've got three rules that we're supposed to be looking through today. Given that I had anticipated that this would be the most discussive group out of the three, and given that the other two have been more discussive than I anticipated, I'm eagerly anticipating lots of discussion here. So without further ado, let's jump into the exception on preventing harm. There's copious amounts of preamble, which I'm sure we've all read. I'm going to hand over who wants to speak first, basically, around this. I think, Neil, you've made a comment. I've made a comment. But the floor is open.
I'm trying to make comments, and maybe I can't make comments. So I might have to validate that from home. I'm working from a hotel right now. But this is Arian.
Oh, hello. And we can't cope without you making comments in line.
No. And I have, as everyone knows, I have a ridiculously long Twitter thread that covers information blocking and the exceptions. But one subpart of that thread really covers the two exceptions associated with corrupt or inaccurate data and misidentification of patients. And the concern that I have is that those could be rather large holes that you could drive a dump truck through. Unless we define criteria for what is meant by corrupt or inaccurate. So, you know, among the examples that I've used is that almost everybody's records have some level of inaccuracy in them because diagnoses were entered wrong, or provisional diagnoses are still in the record, or somebody mistyped something. And if the standard for inaccurate does not incorporate the right of a patient to view the same record that the provider is seeing and correct that record or the ability for another provider who's got a permissible use to be able to see the same information that, you know, provider A has, then I think we're misapplying the corrupt or inaccurate standard. And I think we need a standard that is rare in practice and is confined to cases where the data are known to be garbage due to a bug or other kind of true data level corruption, not near inaccuracy. The second comment is related to the misidentification standard, where if there is no obligation on the data holder, in particular provider organizations, to take reasonable steps to identify and match patients, then that misidentified patient standard could be, again, an easy exception to apply in practice in ways that will limit information flow. So I think for those two main exceptions, there need to be clear standards and clear obligations for counterparties to meet, such that those exceptions should be fairly rare in practice.
And I think that that's a really good point to be made generally about all of the exceptions, that we need to make sure that they are as clearly specified as possible so that we don't have people employing them and getting away with it where, we in our hearts know that they shouldn't.
Yeah, by definition, they are exceptional. How would you propose doing that, Alien?
So again, I think there's a good standard on the corrupt or inaccurate, where I think inaccurate may be a misleading word, and I think we should limit this exception to true data corruption. That is, cases where the data holder knows that the data are not reflective of what parties normally would access due to some hard level data corruption. And again, the standard is not applicable to cases where the record is the record. It's the record that people use or actively manage, but may or may not have some inaccuracies associated with it. And then with respect to the misidentification of patients, I think we, again, should limit the exception to cases where the patient is where we know we are giving the wrong patient's data in response to a request, and there needs to be a standard for business reasonable or appropriate maintenance of patient matching standards and patient matching technology that's sufficient in order to meet the test of patient identification.
Yeah, I mean, this is Anil. I think one way we could think about this would be that if a clinician was to use that record to make clinical decisions, no matter how incomplete it is or how inaccurate it is, because it is being used for clinical purposes or clinical decision-making, then that record should be shared. I don't think we're going to be able to expect that the record is going to be fully complete or that it's going to be fully accurate for all the reasons. And I agree, you don't want people to say, I'm not going to share it because it's inaccurate, when they're already making clinical decisions and then reading past the inaccuracies, for example, to do that. So I think we do have to come up with some examples where it is a technical corruption, it is a technical issue that would prevent someone from actually using that record, that should also then prevent them from sharing that record.
And I'll validate that, from the clinician's perspective. We have recently been entertaining requests and having a discussion in my organization about the desirability of, for example, being able to see notes that are still in progress or encounters that remain active and open. For example, if a patient's in the hospital in one institution and they're primary care provider or a consulting specialist is in another institution and they want to be able to interact with the information, or if you make a referral, if I as a PCP make a referral to a specialist and I haven't gotten around to closing my note and I've gone on vacation, it's still valuable for that specialist to be able to look at my note in progress, even if it's not finalized, to be able to glean whatever information. We allow folks within our own institutions to do that, to see documentation in progress. We shouldn't limit that to individuals that might be accessing the data remotely.
Yeah, I mean,
but,
this is
a,
oh, go ahead, Neil. I was going to say, this is, sorry, Andrew. This is Anil again. I clinically, when we practice and when I was practicing, there would be occasions where two patients were erroneously merged. Okay, so you can call that an identification issue, or you can call it a corrupt record, whatever you want to call it. As a clinician, we were immediately aware that there was a problem here. If a patient was to request that chart, I think that would be a very good reason not to, right? And then to then remediate that, or by contacting health information management and having those records be separated until it was mitigated, you wouldn't want to share it. So I think having examples, and that's what I was trying to get to in my comments on the spreadsheet,
where there are some very tangible examples of where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate, I think would help, because we're dealing with an imperfect record, and now we're trying to put some boundaries on it that would, too many reasons why people might hide behind that.
A couple of comments. Let's pick up on Anil's comment just there. You know, if a patient requests a record and we know that there is an entanglement, there is an inadvertent merge taking place, we're still going to give them their record. We're going to merge it first. And the message to the patient is, yes, we're going to give you a record once it's been untangled. So that's not a blocking.
Well, it is, from a timing point of view.
It is blocking. It's timing.
Yeah,
from
it
a timing
is blocking.
Point of view, absolutely.
Well, there's no timing on this exception. And what's it, and in the actual rules, what is it? Is there a time on the blocking?
It's defined in a the way that okay, I'm gonna seek a correction from my from the ONC colleagues, but the way that information is defined in the rule is that the right to access, exchange, and use clinical data for permissible purposes or permissible uses is unlimited unless it's covered by one of the exceptions.
Yeah, I mean,
and
there,
that's
right, yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't believe that the access was...
There is an immediate... Yeah, there is an unreasonable standard, which could be used in some cases for, I want it right now. If you don't give it to me, then you're an information blocker. That could fall into the unreasonable standard. But generally, the right is non-constrained unless covered by an exception.
I can see how rules actually have some boundaries around time. Short, it's one business day, but they actually do have some boundaries.
Well, again, this is one of those, it depends, right? If the data is electronically available and you implement the electronic standards for access, then that's not a reasonable standard. If it's a paper, if it's a record that needs to be copied to a PDF, then you may be, there may be another reasonable standard. But again, I think that would all be, should be discussed under the unreasonable exception as opposed to this exception.
Okay. And the first point I was going to make was that the definition of inaccurate there. If every record is inaccurate, this isn't referring to a record. This is referring just to data. So any data being inaccurate would have rendered the entire record blocked, or should.
That's a
really good point. Yeah, should we be looking at this at the full record level or at a lower level? I mean, it could be an individual piece of data. It could be an individual encounter. It could be some subset of data or encounters.
Now, I might be misreading the text. In many of the reg text, there are caveats that the permitted blocking must be minimal. And I think in this case, if there were subparts of the record that were known to be corrupt, then the minimization of that blocking would argue for just blocking the small subpart that's known to be correct until it's remediated.
I think that's this is Anil. I think that could be really problematic clinically. I mean, we have to trust the judgment of those actors who are making that decision. But let me give you an example. If we were to give a patient their medical record, but we decided that there were some inaccuracies in their allergies, and therefore we withheld the allergy data, but gave everything else, that could cause problems downstream.
Page 387 of the preamble says, we note, however, that known inaccuracies in some data within a record may not be sufficient justification to withhold the entire record if the remainder of the patient's EHI could be effectively shared without also presenting the known incorrect or corrupted information as if it were trustworthy. So that's taken.
Yeah.
What validity does the preamble have versus the actual reg?
Yeah, so I mean, sir, it's a good question that is can be somewhat contentious at times. But so I mean, the regulatory text is what people look to first. But a preamble, it expands on what's in the reg text. So they're supposed to be looked at hand in hand, even though the reg text is really the law in essence that we're. But the preamble is part of it. And should be enforced as well.
The way I think about it, and correct me if I'm thinking about this the wrong way, the way I think about this is that the reg text is the reg text. And in a legal dispute, which these issues are inevitably going to come to some level of legal dispute, it's the reg text that's dispositive. But in cases of ambiguity about what the reg text, reasonable ambiguity about what the reg text actually means, the preamble or commentary provides guidance for interpretation.
Yeah, so I think there's not. I'm not going to say that I have the answer, but I think that's generally right. But it is open to interpretation. I will say that throughout when we're writing regulations, you never want there to be conflicting information in reg text and preamble. Like, there should never be a requirement in preamble that's not in reg text. Really, the requirements should all be included in reg text, and then the preamble acts to explain and provide examples and highlight our thinking behind the reg text. I think courts might disagree on how it's enforced, perhaps, but that's generally what we do.
Okay. We need to make the reg text then as accurate as possible without causing bloat.
Right. And by the way, the clause that I was thinking of is B4, which is no broader than the policy must be no broader than necessary to mitigate the risk of harm. And then same thing for C, which is practice necessary, no broader than necessary to mitigate the risk of harm. So again, I think that covers the case where portions of the record are corrupt, and it's reasonable to provide the rest of the record without that portion of the record.
Shouldn't that be in A as well then? That same statement. I like the statement, no broader than necessary to mitigate the risk of harm. Because A,
no,
B,
that,
and
so
C.
This is the standard of the practice. So the way that the exception works is that it defines the practice. The practice must meet the terms under A, which are corrupt, misidentified, or actual harm. And then there's two tests for the practice. One is whether it's based on an organizational policy, and that organizational policy must be minimal. Or if it's ad hoc, then it must be documented in writing and also minimal.
Yeah, because the condition is that it must meet the following conditions, apart from two of them being ifs.
Right, it must meet all of the following conditions. And that's right. Wasn't clear to me the first time I read this.
Actually, it doesn't say all the following conditions. It says the following conditions are all relevant.
Right, that seems ambiguous.
Yeah.
I mean,
The way I think about this, and I'd love for correction, is that it really part A is the major portion, and then part B and C are qualifications on the policies that are used for enforcing part A. If it's an organizational policy, it must meet all the tests under part B, and if it's an ad hoc policy, it must meet all the tests under part C.
Yeah, so I really, when I first read this, I was really worried that B was the big door that they would drive the truck through, because all they needed was to have a policy. So you just clarified this for me, that it has to be A first, and then they need to have a policy.
Yep. Or ad hoc.
Well, then
ad hoc
they
document
could,
right. writing.
Right.
There's
have a policy
burden.
Or,
yeah.
Right. Or make a finding,
yeah.
As they say.
If they do have a policy, it has to support those four things. And if it's ad hoc,
right.
You have to make a discrete finding.
Perfect. Can we dive into A3 a little bit, just as we're starting in on this? I just want to set the table a bit. Is that timely?
Sure. Yeah, it does.
So I've done a lot of work in the area of adolescent confidentiality, and it's a very thorny area. And I think that we have challenges in endangering the safety of patients when we think about adolescent data, where you might have an adolescent who has the right to access their own health information, but they've also got a parent or guardian who has potentially the right to access that information, and the parent or guardian accessing that information could potentially put the patient in danger. In our organizational policies, as well as many such policies around the country, we basically prohibit access for parents, guardians, for kids between the ages of 12 and 17 inclusive, even to the point of not allowing the adolescent to give consent to release the data, because that could be done under duress. Yes, exactly. So I think, to me, that's a big area that we need to think about in terms of this particular piece of the exception. It certainly was the first one that came to my mind when I read preventing harm.
That's a really complicated area, because, as you know, there's state laws in California. I think we've got state laws that line up against that organizational policy. There are states that have actually the entirely opposite law that force disclosure to parents. But some of that would belong in the privacy in, I think it's subpart 3. Is that right? 2?
Yeah, 2.
So in your case, Stephen, the issue that you're raising is where disclosure of this information could cause direct harm based on suspected or, you know, clinical judgment of parental actions.
Right. And it's tricky, too, because there's two levels of disclosure. One is disclosure to the parent guardian, who may otherwise have a right to access a patient's record. The other is disclosure to another organization, where you can't necessarily rely on them having the policies and procedures to protect that information from that disclosure. And when we got to that second piece, we kind of shrugged our shoulders and said, you know, well, we can't not release it. You know, if the patient moves or is getting care in an outside organization, we have to do that. And we've tried to figure out, how is there some way to flag this data as adolescent confidential, with sort of the hope that the receiving organization has some way to deal with that. But in my soul, I never feel like I've done justice to the privacy needs of the adolescent when that data is released.
It occurs to me that this exception is one of the ones where the reg really pushes this to licensed healthcare professional, exercise of professional judgment, reasonable likely to endanger. That it seems like there's broad enough language here that relies ultimately on clinical judgment and interpretation.
And again, this is all about the exceptions, right? This is somebody saying, this is the reason that I didn't release the data. So in some sense, my concern is sort of on the flip side of this. I mean, I'm just saying, I want to make sure that we give organizations the opportunity to protect the privacy and safety, frankly, of adolescents where they feel that's appropriate. And I think, you know, the way this is set up, where this was the reason, this is our policy, or this was the specific finding in this case, it feels like this does cover my use case.
Yeah, the use case that always comes to mind when I see these kinds of statements is around some of the specific mental health conditions. So Munchausen's by proxy, those kinds of things, where actually for the patient to be informed could actually be detrimental to their well-being. Does that make sense? And the
suicide
example
ideation, self propensity for self harm. Yeah, there's a whole bunch.
Exactly. Yeah, but generally in the MH domain, I think the example that's given in the preamble is around domestic abuse and the pregnancy results of a partner, and where the partner has access to the records and there's suspected abuse. I must confess, I find the illustration in the preamble a bit problematic, because that seems to be overstepping the Steve, you know, Anil jumping on me here, but it seems to be potentially overstepping the clinical boundaries. You know, I suspect domestic abuse. Well, that's a bit of a stretch, I think, as an illustrative example. I think, Anil, you just listed a whole bunch of much more relevant ones. And where we talk about a licensed healthcare professional, well, that's a very broad church. You know, everything from nurse practitioners through to clinical social workers and physical therapists. So would it be worth...
I think that's appropriate, though. I don't want to be too physician-centric.
I've got no problems with the statement, just to qualify that the professional judgment needs to be pertinent to the data.
Yep. So I think the key here, guys, is that if there is an organizational policy and it's compliant with local and state rules, and it's applied uniformly without discrimination, then the electronic disclosure should follow that. And we should defer to the licensed professionals and give them an ability to document why the exception was being made. And I think my concern would be, you know, this idea here that's in number three that says that the patient has been afforded any right of review of that determination. I don't quite understand it. I'm not a lawyer. I don't quite understand that one. If we're saying that we have, as clinicians or their stakeholders, have the right to say why they didn't want to release it, but that information then needs to be made available as to why to the patient, that in itself could be problematic. But I don't want to overcomplicate things. I think the way it's written for the most part is pretty good. I just am concerned about how does the health IT vendor and how does the health system deal with this ability to then have a patient review why something was not done. Maybe I'm overcomplicating.
I believe this is under HIPAA, and I'm looking at information excluded from right of access, which includes I'm just looking there. Keep going.
No,
I apologize.
This
is more from ONC. That's primarily where the right of review came from, was under 524. Okay. 164, yep. 524. And so, provided that if required by applicable law or state law, we were very sensitive to the fact that in some states and under federal law, there is a right to review. And so that's where that came from.
Okay. So this is not a special requirement for the exception, documenting the exception itself. Whatever mechanism people do today around HIPAA, we could use that same mechanism so there's no undue additional burden on the healthcare system or the vendor of the IT system.
Right.
They're leveraging
that
exists today.
If required by applicable federal or state law. Yeah.
That's right. Correct.
All right.
That we were trying to, yes, that's what we were trying to do with this exception.
Just so I can... I've got my grammar hat on for a moment. At the end of one, A1, is an or, really, isn't there? It's either A1, A2, or A3.
Well, it could be multiple, yep. But it has to be at least one of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, this is Lauren. If you're still screen sharing, is it possible to zoom in a little bit?
Sorry about that. Let me try to do that.
Yeah, that is, by the way, that should be in each of these areas where there are subclauses, at least one of. And it does, you know, must meet the following conditions, and then it says A, B, and that's actually fine. So for under A, it probably should say arising from at least one of.
it's like that. It's interesting. A is an OR list. B is an AND list.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. But it makes sense.
Well, it makes sense. You just have to read it and reread it. I'm trying to hope we make these things as understandable as possible when someone reads them the first time.
Yeah.
I know that's wishful thinking because it's taken us 27 readings to get this far.
And by the way, I find it helpful to read these as reasons that are permissible, although it's permissible to withhold, so you end up with all these double negatives. But you know, you think about the exception, what's positive for the exception, and it does end up being confusing.
Yeah, this is the allowance to stop me doing to allow me to do something. I need to stop it. Yeah, I get it. In A1, I've highlighted there just for discussion the term recorded. That seems to apply very much to an activity inside an EMR, like within an organisation. Should we consider changing the word recorded for exchanged?
It probably should be accessed.
Or just documented.
Maybe we should just use the language that's in the rest of the information blocking provision that should be accessed, exchanged, or used. And I agree with you that the patient's electronic health record is narrower than the intended application of information blocking provisions, which really cover electronic health information.
Yes.
That's right. Accessed, exchanged, or used.
Yeah, because I think the point here is the data is part of the electronic health record already. Whether or not it's corrupt or inaccurate, the data is there. Should it be accessed, exchanged, or used? Well, no, I don't think it should. I'm going to block it.
Right. And again, the electronic health record, there are activities that fall under the information blocking provisions that are part of electronic health information. It's defined by the definition terms. It may not be part of any EMR or EHR or any coordinated record.
So,
could I play devil's advocate on that?
Yes.
No, I was going to just say I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a moment. I'm reading this a little bit differently, and I'll defer to you experts. But it sounds like, you know, they might be trying to carve out, or we may be trying to carve out, where you may have interfaced, let's say, with, and this happens all the time in clinical medicine, but you've interfaced with the lab has sent incorrect data and you know, being recorded in the chart. It's not made its way into the EHR because it was stopped. And if someone does request all their EHI, electronic health information, we should not have to give that inaccurate data to them. It was never used. It was never accessible. It was never exchanged. It was simply interfaced from a system poorly. And it therefore was inaccurate and corrupt. And I think maybe the word recorded is referring to that activity that never made its way into the EHR.
So I can think of a number of examples in the world that I've lived in where so I'll give you an example of a claim status inquiry in an administrative network where depending on how the patient identification is configured, you could respond with the wrong claim status or the status for the wrong claim. I can give an example. I think the lab one is a good one, but it's not just the lab was incorrect. It also might be that that you know, patient matching logic was misconfigured, and lab records are showing up in the wrong portion of the record or against the wrong patient. Or it could be that there is data corruption and data that's exchanged is corrupt in practice, or that data this happens all the time. You have a lab HL7 lab feed that is misconfigured, and the HL7 data is non-interpretable. And again, you'd want to make sure that all of those would be covered by the provision. And I think the way the provision is written, it's very narrow to the electronic health record and recorded or incorporated. And again, I think if we broaden it and refer back to the access exchange use for electronic health information, I think we get back to the intended ways that cover all of those use cases.
Yeah, I like the term access exchange or used, because used covers both recorded and incorporated.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that same thing would apply both for two as well. Oh, that just says electronic health information, so that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's okay, I think.
Hey, everyone. This is Val. I'm sorry I joined a little bit late. I was just listening to this conversation, and of course, I come at this, at least in my current life, from a health information exchange point of view. And, you know, when I look at this, I certainly understand the misidentification of a patient or, you know, there's often times where we are not confident that we've got an accurate match and it goes in a different bucket and there's a whole manual process to sort of reconcile. And certainly we wouldn't want health information exchanges to send that along. The corrupt or inaccurate data being recorded or incorporated in the EHR, I'm struggling a little bit to sort of step back and say, okay, how would that work sort of from my current sort of vantage point? Because sort of what goes into the HIE is what's sent by the participants, typically providers, coming straight from their EHR, Common Clinical Data Set, or USCDI eventually. So the HIE wouldn't really be in a position to know that there's inaccurate data being transmitted. Clearly, we try to do like data quality checks to the extent we can, but we're not like in the same position as a provider recording stuff in an EHR. So how do you think that would work from the perspective I just described? And I'm sorry if I'm missing something, and
no,
I am
okay.
relatively new to this. I'm totally new.
I think we already provided comment that addresses that, which is that, you know, we believe that, or at least I believe there should be standards for this area. And those standards should be confined to cases where there is a reasonable belief or, you know, knows or likely to, whatever the right language there, that there's actual corruption as opposed to a vague standard of any possible inaccuracy. Which, you know, my comment
okay.
is that every record is inaccurate in some way.
It's
just a matter of, yeah. So we want to confine it to known data corruption in areas that are much more stringent.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Although this does raise the issue of if the message does not conform to standards and is not reasonably interpretable, does that follow under an inaccurate or corrupt standard, or is that, you know, do we need a standard for non-interpretable data?
That's a good point, actually, because I'm just making some notes here that kind of like corruption,
I think,
is technical corruption. Inaccuracy is kind of, excuse the term, clinical corruption. But there is this kind of, you can have something which has been appropriately coded but is ununderstandable. You know, maybe someone's received a system doesn't understand SNOMED. Well, what do you do?
I thought in the preamble they do comment that it could be based on technical issues. I don't think the lack of interpretability of the standard would not be counting. And then there's also other exceptions that might fit into. Right.
It actually says, yeah, this recognized, it says, this, oh, hang on, here's an interesting point. This recognized risk is limited to corruption and inaccuracies caused by performance and technical issues.
Exactly. So wouldn't not being able to interpret the message be a technical issue?
Yeah, so this is an area where we're interpreting the commentary text, but then when you look at the reg text, it's not what the reg text says. So I think the commentary text is right on, and maybe the commentary text should be better reflected in the reg text.
Yeah. Does that mean then that let's say we've got an observation of, I don't know, left kidney failure instead of right kidney? Well, or left kidney removed or something like that. And the actual receiving physician knows that that is not the case. It's an obvious inaccurate observation. That isn't covered by this. This is only...
That's one where it should be a right of correction, but that could also fall under the patient harm exemption if you're sending, you know, left kidney removal, and it's really right kidney removal that creates a risk of a wrong side surgery.
Yeah. Well, I've had a case.
Yeah, but the way clinically, I mean, the way that's clinically handled would be that just as Stephen said, I mean, you'd fix the error, you'd make the change, and then you would exchange the record or provide the record. I think those are probably easier to deal with because there's clinical context. I think the harder ones is when where there's corruption or, you know, there's been mixing of records and merging, inappropriate merging and things of that sort. That's probably the one where I think we want to make sure we address for sure.
So
right.
If this spec is purely about technical corruptions, how is a clinician going to make a informed decision that there is a error of a technical nature?
I can give you plenty of examples. So, you know, we typically will review the chart, right, when we're seeing a patient. Let's assume for a moment that there has been, and this happens in every EMR world, that someone has used that record to do some testing or to try something out, like a new widget or whatever. And you start to see 100 different comorbidities in the problem list that are clearly, by human eyes, a problem. Well, what we typically do is make a referral to health information management and say, hey, go figure out why this record is all messed up. And I would not give a copy of that record to a patient because it would be wrong to do that. And I think that's an example of where it's obvious that there's corruption there. Where it's not obvious that there's corruption, I think all bets are off. I mean, that's what happens today. We see that all the time in exchange. But I think when a doc or another clinician, a licensed practitioner, knows there's corruption involved because they can see it, it's obvious, then I think they have an obligation to do something about it and prevent that record from being shared if they think it's going to cause harm.
Yeah, wait,
One is
the obligation to do something about it. The other is the obligation to prevent sharing. And I think I want to optimize sharing and encourage sharing. So how do we encourage corrections to be made in such a way that corrected data can be shared appropriately, as opposed to giving people an exception where they say, well, we just don't have a process to correct our data and therefore we're just not going to share it.
Well, I think that policy, the organizational policy, would be required there, right? Isn't that already spelled out?
Well, it says no broader than necessary to mitigate the risk of harm, but it doesn't provide an obligation to, in the case of corruption or misidentification, to correct the corruption or misidentification. And that
I
might
think
be
somewhere
a,
in the
a,
preamble.
A comment.
Yeah, in the preamble, I thought there was language around that, but I could be wrong.
But the preamble isn't the reg text.
I get it. And maybe something needs to be brought forward into the reg text, but they do talk about mitigating the error or mitigating the problem.
Yeah, that could be interpreted under no broader than necessary to reduce harm. Hey, I do think we need to add to the standard of corrupt, also uninterpretable, which is slightly different from corrupt.
Uninterpretable by what standard and according to whom?
Yeah, so what happens all the time in information what happens all the time in information exchange or for networks is that you get, I don't know, an HL7 feed or an ANSI X12 feed, and you parse the record, and sometimes that record fails to parse because it doesn't meet the standards that are applicable for that record, and you kick it out. and you return it back to sender, or you put it through your exception process for communication back to the originating endpoint.
Actually, in the case of an HIE, the ones which are agnostic to the actual carrier, to what the semantics of the data, they will actually persist it and exchange it, whatever, without actually parsing.
Yeah, I'm thinking more of cases for orders and results interchange, cases for EDI interchange, and the like. So remember the definition. Yeah, the definitions here are HIE, but also health information network, that is transmission of electronic health information between two dissimilar entities. And
I spent 2 hours on that definition this morning. Don't worry.
Absolutely. And it's really confusing as to what's included or not included. But at least according to that standard, there's a whole bunch of things where, you know, you get an HL7 feed in, you kick out some of them because they just don't make any sense. And that's the way
I'm storing the delta here between syntax of HL7 and semantic of the vocabulary or terminologies that have been used within it. I think we're on the same page. We're saying the same thing.
Yeah, and in some cases, we've incorporated information into a record, but there is some information that's uninterpretable. And so you incorporate part of the record, but not the whole thing, because there's a portion that's uninterpretable. It's just because that's the garbage you got. And
okay.
I think that would meet, so, but, I think but, that should meet the standard.
I agree. The point is that this exception is purely where there has been a technical glitch.
Right.
It's not where Dr. Lane has recorded something completely egregious and I just don't agree with him and don't think it's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
And technical corruption needs to include cases where, you know, there's standards failures or other failures where the data are uninterpretable.
And is the clinician who's making this judgment call perfectly legitimately obligated to record why? I can't find anything in the regs. Can someone point to me if it is there?
There's well-documented organizational policies, or it's ad hoc and there is an obligation to record why.
But where do I record it?
It's either in the org policy or it's in the specific findings.
Yeah, the making of the finding. Presumably that needs to be recorded somewhere. Or...
Yeah. Let's make and record a finding.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
You know what these doctors are like. for the purpose of the record, that was a joke. So make and record a finding, and I think if the practice implements an organisational policy, the policy must be all these things and include a recording of the finding.
Yeah, you should capture that in your comments.
Yeah, well, I think we need to be careful though not to have. So in the case of clinical determination, I agree. In the case of corrupt or misidentified, if you have a burden to record the reason for all of these things, then you put a bunch of operating process in what's often an emergent situation.
I thought we'd established that the only way that this exception would play is if it was a technical corruption. So it's only, mm-hmm. is it only ever going to be a clinical observation of either a technical corruption or a misidentification.
Or it could be a technical identification of a technical corruption.
Yep.
Or there could be an automated process. And again, in the examples that I've been using of an HL7, you know, HL7 message that fails to hit standards, I hit it with an error response, or a 997 response in an 837, ANSI X12 context. And
yep.
That's my determination is, hey, this thing fails.
Well, 837 is going to be returned to sender saying this is a malformed claim. And HL7 is probably going to add it to a queue and someone's going to eyeball it.
Yeah. But it's not a written determination that for each one of those rejections, I got to go back and note in an audit log that's inspectable by a.
Oh, no, but in those in your 837 example, that would be written to an audit log to say that this particular message, this ID was rejected and sent to that sender. That's a record. Where you've got someone eyeballing an HL7 message says this is malformed, return to sender, that would be
recorded. So a lot of these things, if you need to keep the logs around forever, logs can be incredibly voluminous, and you've increased the cost of exchange pretty significantly for the off chance that somebody's going to go audit you for information blocking provisions, as opposed to something where I say, I'm following written standards, and here's how I follow the written standards in the case of audit. I'm just trying to make sure we don't put in.
When the clinician makes a finding, it should be recorded.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's appropriate. Let's put the burden on the clinicians.
We should just be articulating what they decided.
Well, and, we chuckle, but it's important, and I think the habit and even the willingness of physicians to document that sort of thing is quite variable. So if we're going to, and of course there's such a sensitivity these days about clinician burden and the challenge of regulations increasing that burden, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to think through and assure that really is the right place. I mean, it sounds like it is, but we should not make that judgment lightly.
Yep, that's right.
Thankfully, you have two clinicians on this very small work group, so
this is a good thing. You know, part of A3 is also a competency test that you'll be going to to determine whether how competent the patient will be to receive that information as part of that judgment call.
All right, say that again.
I would imagine that as part of A3, when you're actually determining whether you're going to withhold information from a patient, there's a competency decision in the middle of all that as well about how competent they are to receive that data.
I don't know about that. I'm not sure you want to include medical literacy or...
I'm not.
Okay.
Discussion point more than anything else.
There's a whole bunch of things
you're making at the moment in time.
Isn't that covered all under permissible use? So the blanket provision here is that it has to be access, exchange, or use for a permissible use.
Yeah, my only point with raising that was saying there is a large number of decisions that a clinician is making at that point of time, and it's not that they're only making this disclosure decision. That was all I was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. How comfortable are we with B as it stands? I noticed, Stephen, you've highlighted the word and.
I read better when I can see the high points. I'm being selfish. You pointed out that one was an or and one was an and list, and I'm just helping us without monkeying with the text too much here.
Yeah, I did the indents just to help.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
I need to drop at this point. I apologize, but I've gotten through. We got through the exception that I've had the most commentary on that I think was under our remit today. So,
are you comfortable where we are?
I'm very comfortable where we are.
Okay, because I'm recognizing the fact that you have been thinking about this for probably longer than most of us have been thinking about health IT, and you are comfortable. Okay, that's good.
Thank you.
So Andrew, to your question, this is Anil, to your question, yes, I'm comfortable with how B looks.
Cool.
I think it covers what we discussed.
And I'm in agreement.
That's good. This is actually
better than you thought.
It's gone smoother than the other one. Well, it's gone smoother than the other work groups, I'll tell you that. Okay. I struggle a bit with B2 in the A1
is clearly about technology. A2, oh, I see. A2 is a clinical determination. And then A3 is clinical. Okay, fine. Yeah. When you use language like and other appropriate, I'm like, okay. Just seems a bit.
You said
broad.
You were struggling with. You said you were struggling with B2.
B2, just what's it says other appropriate, yeah.
Well, and also the whole issue of expertise, right? I mean, how deep does that go? In whose eyes? You know, by whose judgment, right? I mean, is organization A's expertise that they bring to bear, you know, as comprehensive as organization B's? And I guess the point of all of these is that these will be trotted out when there is an accusation of information blocking, right? And that the OIG or whoever is investigating this would look to these rules to evaluate the charge, right?
Yeah,
so they would determine whether the expertise was appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is Anil. I kind of like the idea that it's a little bit vague in terms of other appropriate expertise because some of this will be as Stephen said, some of this will happen over time, and you know we don't want to have a very specific type of skill be represented and then keep adding to it. If you put other appropriate expertise, that gives some wiggle room for an organizational policy that matches their institution.
The other type of expertise that certainly comes to my mind is operational. So many of these issues related to interoperability and why it does or doesn't happen have to do with having workflows and operational processes in place, often at least as much as the clinical and technical processes. So if one were going to supplement B2, I would at least consider adding operational to that short list.
So I think it'll be institution dependent, but some healthcare systems that we do business with, for example, those people that Steve is talking about would either be in the clinical support organization or in the technical, the IT office. So if adding the word operational is more inclusive, that's great. But I think it all depends on the institution, what those folks are considered.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in our institution, which is a very large one, it's very clear, you know, there are clinical leaders, there are operational leaders, there are technical leaders, and there are totally different groups. And the clinical folks, while we, you know, contribute to discussions about how operations does things, you know, we don't control it. You know, we've got a COO, we've got a CIO, we've got, you know, clinical leads. So, but you're right. I mean,
right.
Certainly in a small office practice, you know, there's a lot of overlap.
I think, put my grammar hat on again, the use of a term relevant and the use of a term appropriate in this exception, I think, is back to front. So I think in B2, we should say relevant expertise. And I think in the opening salvo ahead of A, we should say at all appropriate times. I'm not so sure on that one, but I think appropriate, certainly in B2, should be relevant. That's just a grammar police.
Well, that's not grammar, that's diction, and it's important.
Okay. I think it's relevant expertise. I'll make a note. Mark's sitting there going,
I think you're right. No, I think that's fair. So you're talking about basically just flipping those two words, appropriate and relevant.
Yeah, the point being that something is relevant if it's appropriate or connected to the matter. Relevant things are helpful. Relevant things are appropriate and make sense at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, relevant is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Who wax lyrical about the advantages of a British education at this point. Okay, C.
So
Actually, we use the term practice. In B and C, we use practice both times.
Right, because this is directed at the healthcare entity.
So should we say entity?
Right. Or is the word practice clinically?
This is the verb practice, not the noun.
Oh, practice. I gotcha. Okay.
Yes. Comes from the statute. This is Morris from ONC. It's the practice, not a verb.
Okay. I gotcha. Okay. Well, so then that's fine, right?
Someone just define it. What is the practice in this context?
The action.
The practice. The action that was accused of being information blocking.
Okay, yeah, so if they're preventing harm, if the exception implements an organizational policy, that doesn't make sense.
There, it's in the top line there. I just turned it red. Practices that are reasonable and necessary.
Got it. But if I look at B2, if the practice does not implement.
Oh, but the practice itself is done to implement the policy. So that that's still the verb practice, or it's
still wrong.
It's the action. Why is it wrong?
If the action of doing this implements an organizational policy, why would the action of doing
it instantiates a policy, or is consistent with a policy?
If the practice is instantiated in policy, and if the practice, and then C, just is cumbersome now, but B, if the practice is instantiated in an organizational policy, the policy must be. Okay, so if the policy is defining this practice, got it. If this practice has not been implemented in an organizational policy, then you have to make a finding in each case.
Can I make a recommendation? If the practice invokes an organizational policy, the policy must be, because it's the practice has to invoke a reason why it's resulting in a block. So it has to be invoking a policy, right? It's not you're not going to be implementing
a
policy at the time of the practice.
Yeah.
Has to be done
if an organization implements an organizational policy of this practice. Who's going to take that one on, Stephen?
I think you took more grammar than I did. I mean, I think it could be clearer, but I think it's also acceptable as it is.
Appreciate that.
Since we have the author on the phone, right?
who wrote this on the phone?
Well, a number of people at ONC over time.
Okay, so it's got plausible deniability for... the policy.
But
yeah, because C has a few issues in it. If you say if the practice does not implement an organizational policy, the activity wouldn't implement anything.
Well, I definitely see what you're saying, but I guess if there was an interference based on harm that was listed in the policy, that's what we were getting at. The practice,
interference
with.
Yeah. I'm happy to see that notwithstanding.
Did we want to go back and say that an actor must make and record a finding? I mean, did we discuss how that finding that they've made would have to be somewhat available later on?
I'll pick that up in the notes that said,
please include
that when a clinician makes a finding, it should be recorded.
Okay. All right.
Somewhere accessible. Not on the post-it note on my monitor.
Okay.
We're only 72 minutes into the call. Shall we move on to promoting the privacy of electronic health information?
Sure. It's not, you know, we can always go back, right? I think as
we will.
I think taking a first pass at each of these is a good thing.
Yeah, that's kind of the approach we've adopted in the other work groups as well. Okay, who's going to open on this? Okay, so this exception is you need to do one of the lettered things.
A, B.
Oh, trust me, it's really confusing numbering. There you go.
I think my broader point on this one, and again, it may not make sense. Maybe the preamble covers it in more detail than I had time to skim, but you know, this seems like there's a lot of onus on the organization, and somehow it needs to be tied in with other institutional mandates that this should be leveraged instead of, it just seems like a lot of onus. And so I put a comment in here that you guys can see that, you know, it's not clear to me what the overhead requirements for organizations to address all the policies would be for this one, because back to Stephen's point that he made earlier about, you know, the adolescent who you may want to limit information sharing, for example, you know, how does that get instrumented in the context of this particular rule above and beyond what might already exist in HIPAA?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
I'll just pass it over to you because A1 is basically the A1's definition of HIPAA comes from HIPAA, doesn't it? So, yes, I agree with you now. So A gives us this whole definition of individual. Out of interest, anyone got any insight as to what any other natural person means?
Sounds very legal.
It begs the question of what an unnatural person is.
Oh, a natural person. Okay, this is Morris from ONC. So as opposed to a corporation or a limited liability company. That's what we mean by natural person using, of course, that's what we mean by that. An actual human being.
Well,
how about that?
Wait, so what was the point of making that distinction?
So we used, the purpose is that, given that the HIPAA privacy rule and state law, we wanted to make it consistent with those laws. And so there were several buckets of what we were trying to capture, because electronic health information is broader than just HIPAA, covered entities and business associates. And so an individual under A1 is the HIPAA definition. And so what we were trying to capture are other human beings' information that was outside the definition of HIPAA. So, for example, that's
what
we were trying to capture.
So does this mean other people, this is like the note about the husband that references the wife? Is that another person who is the subject of the information?
Well, I'll give you an easy example. In certain situations, let's say a health IT developer is not subject to HIPAA, but they have access to individually identifiable health information. So in that case, they would be another person who would be the subject of EHI. That would be an example. Another example would be a concierge medicine physician who doesn't electronically bill but has patients. That would be another example of who would be subject to EHI.
That's helpful. Okay.
Is that okay?
It's interesting, actually. I find the preamble clearer than the reg on this one. Because they say, the reg actually says, an individual defined by 16103, two, a person who is the subject of EHI that is being accessed, exchanged, or used. Three, a person who acts legally on behalf of an individual person. I find the preamble easier. I mean, it's just the use of the word person, natural, was in there. Okay. Proxies, yes. Okay, fine. I'm happy with A, apart from that. Neil, Stephen?
I'm good with A.
B. If the act is required by a state or federal privacy law to satisfy a condition prior to providing access, exchange, or use. See, the term access, exchange, or use, that's just the right way of referring to it. I think going back to our previous rule, when we talked about, was it recorded or something like that, or incorporated, access, exchange, or used. The actor may choose not to provide access, exchange, or use of such electronic health information if the precondition has not been satisfied, provided that. Okay. The numbers, so one, the actor's practice, two, if the precondition, and three, the actor's practice. Okay, I think those are ands. However, the I's and II's, I don't know if they are ands, but the capital A, B, C are ors. No, they're ands. ONC guys, can you help us here? In condition one, the I and the II, they look like they might be ors between each other. However, the other I's are ands.
So,
is that right?
Yeah, so the practice either must be implemented and conform to the written organizational policy, or the practice is documented by the actor. So that's an or right there. So that's the same kind of situation that we had in harm, organizational policy or individual practice documented. Then you go down to two here. And then it's an and right there, you can see.
Yeah. You're not adding those, Andy. You're just highlighting them, right? You're not messing with the text itself.
No, I'm just highlighting it right now. I'm not actually.
Okay, good. Sorry.
Yeah. But that one, anyways, this is a bit clunky because then is there an and that's supposed to go in where I am? Just type in capital and right now. Is that supposed to be an and or not?
Well, it's up for comment, I guess I would say. You guys can weigh in on that.
Well, what's the intent of what's drafted right now?
I mean, I think you might be right that an and might be appropriate. I need to think about it more. We are saying that, you know, it's one or the other, the organizational policy the practice is documented, and the practice must be tailored. The practice must be implemented in a consistent, non-discriminatory manner, and if the precondition relies on provision of consent or authorization, blah blah blah, did all the things. So I believe that's right.
Okay, so we think that at the end of two, it should say, instead of two II, it should say, and the actor's practice is tailored to the specific inclusive risk. So basically, this is a one long sentence with the only optionality being between one I and one II.
Everything else is an and.
I think so.
I believe that's right, but I'll look at it some more.
Okay, so let's actually read the actual content now. The practice conforms to organizational policies and procedures that are in writing, specify the criteria, and have been implemented. Okay. Don't we actually say somewhere that policies and procedures are lawful?
You're asking if we say that, or should we say that?
Well, do we
right,
say
when
that?
You say in one I conforms to the actor's organizational policies and procedures, you're saying, do we have to state that those are lawful policies and procedures?
Yeah. Otherwise, I just write an organizational policy and procedure that says, well, everything's really secret. Any suggestions from anyone?
This is Anil. Just repeat again why we should put down that they're lawful. I think.
Well, I'm asking whether we say anywhere in the exception. I'm thinking back to what we were just discussing on preventing harm with
right.
It can be in there.
They have procedures that are in writing, but what if their procedures are flawed? Right.
Yeah. They need to be governed by law.
Yeah.
And we do say, if you require under state or federal privacy law, got that, but my policies, therefore, should also be lawful.
I would assume that maybe we don't make assumptions. I mean, I think in my head, it's a little redundant that the policies would be more than what is legally required, but it's also given the institution an ability to go above and beyond. But if you think we need to write that the policies and procedures must be lawful, I think that's probably overkill, but that's just my perspective.
Well, actually, you say that. I've actually had clients who've bought an entity, moved across the state boundary as they bought that entity, and have implemented the acquiring organizational policies and procedures. And one of them, they bought a physicians group in Pennsylvania, and all of a sudden found themselves completely off kilter with state privacy legislation.
Yeah. Yeah, I will defer to the team. I think that if that's the case, that if we start to put that in here, we'll need to put that in every single place where we allow an actor to have an organizational policy.
Well, isn't there a catch-all place that people could put that?
Well,
that we could put it at one place that covers the entire rule?
What if we put it in the material prior to the exceptions and say that all organizational policies and procedures must comply with local, state, and federal rules, laws?
Yeah, that would work for me. Mark, can you make that note?
Oh, yeah, on the actual document you're talking about?
Well, yeah, because it's not inside any of the, because we've got the specific exceptions here. And I think the logical place to put it would be in, actually, let's just look for the term lawful. Hang on. Okay, lawful practices.
I mean, if we're going to make the term
doesn't appear. It's not said anywhere in the rule as it stands.
Yeah, I will say that, Andrew, I'm sure you've had the same experience, but I think if we're going to make comments about how institutions must organize and have their policies, then you might need to go further and say that they need to be reviewed every year, or that they need to be reviewed every other year, or something like that. I think
I wouldn't go that far. That's operational.
Okay. All right.
And an organization determining how they reasonably should act. But I do think it's legitimate to say that a policy should be lawful.
Sure. Yep.
And I'm just... Okay, there isn't any... I'm looking at the actual drafting of the rule. There is nothing ahead of a practice shall not be treated as information blocking if the actor satisfies an exception to the information blocking provision, blah, blah, blah. There's nothing ahead of that. So it might actually be that we put it in, if we agree, and I will look for the consensus across the group, not just me forcing this one. If we'd agree, we'd probably insert it every time that we have a reference to an organizational policy.
Or couldn't it just be inserted up front, as you suggested earlier?
There isn't anywhere up front without adding a line. Okay, well, we can add a line at the beginning of in our blue box for preventing harm. Actually, that first two lines is the general statement across this entire section, subpart B. I'll make a note. We can come back to it. Oh, someone's made a note. Ooh.
Yeah, that was me, Andy. and I guess if you just a suggestion, if you were thinking of adding it kind of as an overarching principle, I'm not weighing in on whether that's good or bad. There is like a discussion about the exceptions overall before we get into the meat of each exception, like prior to the harm discussion. So that
it's just two lines long, though, isn't it?
What's two lines long?
It's pretty short. The discussion about the exceptions at the beginning of subpart B, it's very short. It's 171-200, which is like 2.5 lines.
No, I was talking about in preamble, I guess. But
I'd like this in the reg.
Yep. If possible.
And just because I noticed it as we went back to it, in 201B, we talk about an organizational policy. In 202, B, we talk about organizational policies and procedures. Is that meant to be a difference there?
I was just making a note. Say that one more time, where you are.
In the do no harm one, we talked about organizational policy, singular. In the privacy exception, we talk about organizational policies and procedures. Is there a difference? Is there a reason for that difference?
Go ahead.
This is Morse again. The term policies and procedures came from state privacy laws as well as from HIPAA. That's where that language comes from.
Okay. I like it. I find it more inclusive. And maybe we could let that filter into the previous one as well. It's good language.
Andrew and team, I mean, there is in the preamble, I know that we're not talking about the preamble right now, but in the preamble, there is a comment about a qualifying organizational policy. And I'm assuming in the regs, there's something about a qualifying organizational policy. Is that fair?
Is that qualifying policy or qualifying organization?
No, qualifying organizational policy, page 391.
Is that referring to an organization that's qualifying or to a policy that's qualifying?
No, it's saying that we anticipate that an actor would demonstrate that the practices it engaged in were consistent with an organizational policy, that were objectively reasonable and no broader than necessary. I think it does fit what we're trying to discuss here. My only point was that there may be, even though it might not be in the exceptions area, there may be definitions, and I'm really asking the ONC team, there may be a definition of what a qualifying organizational policy, what is an acceptable one, where we can throw all this language into if it doesn't already exist, as opposed to dealing with it in the exceptions, because organizational policy does have a role in other parts of the rule.
Yeah, so there's I don't believe there's a definition of organizational policy, but we do discuss it and the within the preamble.
Seven times. Yeah. Qualifying organizational policy.
Okay. So anyway, well, I was just suggesting was that it may be in the definitional area as opposed to trying to do it in the exception so that it's consistent with the rest of the regs.
Yeah, you heard Arian's views on the regs versus the preamble. It's not in the regs. So.
Right.
Okay, let's go back to 202. The actor's practice in writing specifies. Yeah, I think in 1I, B1I, my only concern is that the policy is lawful. Because all that could be true, but it might actually be something that isn't lawful.
And you made the good point earlier that it was consistent with, you know, both state and federal laws.
With that, in B2, if the precondition relies on the provision of consent or authorization from an individual, would that consent be recorded?
I
or
would
be
say
dissent,
yes.
Actually. Yeah,
no,
be dissent in this case.
To be.
Yeah.
So the documented provision of consent or authorization?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, here they're referring to the precondition. So this is the requirement of the state and federal privacy law. So we can't determine whether the state or federal privacy law requires that consent be documented.
Oh, absolutely. But then, no, we can't. But can't we say that if you're depending upon a dissent expressed under state privacy law, you can record that fact, right?
Say that again.
It says, if the precondition relies on the provision of consent or authorization for an individual, okay. the fact that the ACTA did all things reasonably necessary within its control to provide the individual meaningful opportunities to provide the consent or authorization, okay, and did not encourage, should it not be recorded that I did not encourage this, I provide them with meaningful opportunity, and the patient expressed dissent?
Right, and specifically that 2II says so did not improperly induce them to not provide the consent.
But yeah, which I think is
we're not
expressed dissent.
Didn't discourage consent.
Isn't consent a fairly binary thing? You either give it or you don't.
Generally, yes. I mean, you consent to specific practices or actions.
And we can imply consent or we can get express consent.
Oh, and here they're referring to a precondition that
I think what they're saying,
requires,
guys. Yeah. So if I'm a provider and I'm required to have consent before I could share, but I don't make a reasonable attempt to get that consent from a patient, then I can't use this reason to do it because I didn't do everything I needed to do. So I can't use that precondition. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm the actor.
Right.
And I can't hide behind something that I should have done that I didn't do.
Right,
and,
because
and
you
then,
didn't put the workflow in place. Right.
Exactly, yeah.
And you don't either improperly encourage or induce them to not. Yeah, I mean, it seems
right.
Pretty clear as written.
Yeah, yep, I agree. Andrew, it seemed like you had an issue. Maybe I misunderstood.
My quietness is me rereading again and again and again from the top of B downwards. I just want to know what it is that we're looking to achieve with the statement, and I think I'm okay with it.
I think if I were to boil this down into English, I think what they're saying is, look, if all the requirements weren't satisfied, you have better not been the reason they weren't satisfied before you can claim that you were okay not sharing the information. It has to be something beyond your control.
Yes, I agree with that.
Or capacity.
How many lawyers wrote this?
I can't confirm that.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, well. My sister's a lawyer, and you should see the email she writes to me.
I imagine conversations is going on between all the ONC guys right now saying, oh, these idiots from high tech, don't we understand what we want?
But I do think what the summary you guys gave for what we're trying to get at there is accurate.
Cool.
I agree, Mark. Yeah, I agree. That's what we're trying to get at.
Should we go on to C?
Okay. Let's go to C. Health IT developer of certified health IT not covered by HIPAA. Okay, so health IT developer. So actually, dumb question, Anil.
Yeah.
In our experience, this is an awful lot of health IT developers, right?
Sure.
If I say that one more time. There's a whole bunch that would not be covered entities, for example, right? I mean, there's
right.
a whole bunch.
IBM.
Yeah.
For example.
Well, no, not necessarily.
No,
we have BAAs with our health system clients, but we're not going to talk about that right now.
That's a good point. Yeah, right. So you could be covered by virtue of having a BAA. So this is a non-covered entity not yoked by a BAA to HIPAA.
Yeah, I imagine this is people like apps, developers, and that kind of stuff.
Again, so long as they're not serving as a VAA.
Certified health IT as well.
There's a discussion in the preamble where we get into, I mean, I can pull it up if you'd like, but we go into the types of actors that we're talking about. And I think we do note that we expect this to be a small number. So, Anil, if you think that it's a bigger number, that might be something to clarify, if you think there are lots of these types of folks out there.
So Mark, well, I mean, you... I was going to say that. I think you're saying certified health IT, you know, that could be a module. That could be a module that's, EHR 2015 rules. And so if that's a module and it's an app that could be sitting in an EHR, you can certainly have a lot of these folks out there, in my opinion, based on what I understand.
So just to clarify, this is Morris again with ONC, and that is
potential folks.
We're thinking
potential
of
folks.
Yeah, I see. We were thinking of, not covered by HIPAA, meaning covered entities and business associates and subcontractors who are business associates. So these are non-covered entities and non-business associates, because we assume all business associates are going to have a BAA, a business associate agreement. So that was sort of the thinking behind it. That's who we meant.
Okay, so the inclusion criteria for this is you're not covered by HIPAA, got that, but your IT is certified health IT.
Yeah.
Because why is it certified C for certified H for health, not capitalized? Because isn't that a defined term?
No, health IT is not. And so... Health IT developer certified health IT is, if you look in the definitions, we define health IT developer certified health IT as a developer who at the time of the conduct that's in question, that is believed to be an interference with access, exchange, or use, had at least one product certified under the program, but the conduct doesn't have to be related to that product. So it's broader. But there is a tie-in to having at least one product certified in the program. And we do request, I mean, it's outside the scope of this group, but we request comments on that definition, I believe.
So, and this particular point refers to everyone who doesn't fit that. It's folks who are not covered by HIPAA. So I got to read this one more carefully, but... yeah, I agree with, based on what you guys have said, it sounds like it's going to be a smaller number than I was thinking.
Yeah, again, grammar police, it's the health IT developer that's not required to comply with HIPAA, not the certified health IT that's not required to comply with HIPAA.
Wait, where do you see that? Because it says if the actor is a health IT developer of certified health IT, that is not required. So it's all.
Yeah. No. There's no grammar in that sentence. So if the actor is a health IT developer of certified health IT that is not required to comply with the HIPAA privacy law when engaging in a practice which promotes the privacy interests of an individual, the compliance with the HIPAA privacy rule is dependent of the health IT developer, not of the certified health IT.
So it does go to the actor, but we say electronic health information provided that the actor's practice. So we're talking about the conduct by the actor.
I know. Yeah.
Oh, shoot. I'm getting a cut. I think Lauren is saying something to me, but I can't see the screen. There it is.
Oh, that's okay.
Yep. 4 minutes. I'm looking. Oh, wow, Mark, you've done something very peculiar with your screen now.
Yeah, this is like a matrix right here or something, right?
I'm in the tunnel. Yes, in 3 minutes we'll go to public comment. No worries.
I broke it.
I understand what the sentence is trying to say. It's just very long and very non-grammatically helpful.
I think definitely if you have suggestions for improving it, I think that's fine. I was just trying to clarify.
Okay. Yeah, I've always say who is not required to comply with the HIPAA article. But the rest of it, I'm fine with it. That makes sense. Although meaningfully is quite a subjective term. Steve, Anil, what do you think?
Right. Bill, meaning according to whom?
I'm not sure what meaningfully means, but I'm not sure that's our biggest issue with this one yet.
So I can give you the this is Morris again. What we're trying to get at are the purpose behind that was the word meaningfully was a notice. Some type of notice needs to be disclosed to the person's product or service, similar to a notice that you would see, a notice of privacy practices. So it can't just be a flyby. What we meant by is plain language, something that is meaningful to a person, as opposed to just clicking on something and saying, okay, that's what we were, that was the concept we were trying to get at.
Yeah, we're trying to get it like Morris is saying, like not just checking a box, like, you know, actually providing a real opportunity, which is hard, I guess, to describe
today.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, is there
we understand what you're getting for? Okay.
Is there a process that's written in another rule like HIPAA that you could refer back to so that the word meaningfully is not vague?
Yeah, that word meaningfully disclosed does come from the privacy rule when they talk about the notice of privacy practices.
Maybe a reference there. Maybe putting a reference there would help.
Okay.
I mean, just as a shortcut to trying to get folks to understand what meaningfully disclosed means in the context of this language.
Yeah, we have a model. ONC had a model notice that talked about meaningfully disclosed. Okay.
Did someone document, Andy, did you get that down in the Google Doc? Because I don't have it open anymore.
Yeah, no, I'll do that right now. It's 10 to the hour. I'd like to, Lauren, if we can open the lines for public comment, I think.
Yep, absolutely. Operator, can you open the comment to the public line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
I see we have another small group today, so we'll see if we have any public comments. Any comments in the queue at this time?
No comments at this time.
Okay, guys, you've just won back 10 minutes if you want to wrap up the last bit here. Otherwise, we can break or plan for our next meeting.
I'm okay with that to try and get to the end of this, but guys, what do you want?
Well, I wouldn't mind getting 9 minutes back, but if we need to go until 6, I'm happy to do that.
Well, let's try and get to the end of this exception.
Yeah, let's try to get through it.
Has anyone else got any concerns with C?
Certainly similar to what we've been through already.
Okay. I won't raise policy.
So can someone remind us what's in this part of CFR? We're
Mark,
indeed.
You want to take it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy to take it. So we refer to the privacy rule here, the specific provisions of the HIPAA privacy rule. A1 is basically a right of access with some limited exceptions. So you have a right to get a copy of your protected health information and designated record set. And the, certain exceptions don't apply, such as psychotherapy notes, information compiled in a reasonable anticipation of a civil or criminal action. And so that's the basics of A1. A2 talks about what we call unreviewable grounds for denial. So if you go to your medical records department, let's say in a hospital, they can deny access without review in certain situations. For example, in a correctional institution, in a research protocol, or if it's subject to the Privacy Act, or there is a promise, a contract of confidentiality. So that would be A2. A3 are what we're called the reviewable grounds of denial. So if a patient goes to a hospital, they deny your medical records, you can have that request reviewed for an appeal. And usually it requires, usually a physician, but a licensed healthcare professional that believes that the person is likely to be in danger, sounds familiar, likely to be in danger of the life or physical safety of the individual or another person, or they believe it's going to cause substantial harm, let's say a parent who believes in some type of child abuse. The patient can review that decision for denial based upon some due process rights. So hopefully I've covered it. A reasonable period.
Now that's really helpful. Since it sounds like so much of this is already covered in HIPAA,
right?
Did we really need to do as much as we did, you know, up above?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So the first, the answer, well, I can just tell you what our intent was. The first one, let me give you a good example. The precondition question is one in which, for example, under the privacy rule, you can only send a minimum necessary amount of information. There's that standard for non-treatment purposes, such as operations,
right,
and that type of thing. And so that would apply in those situations where, for example, a recipient would want more information than minimum necessary. And the covered entity would say, no, we can't do that because it hasn't met our precondition of minimum necessary. In this example, we're talking about specific requests by an individual which has been denied by a covered entity for access to their protected health information, generally their medical record. So there are two different concepts we're trying to get at. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just a note, overall, I mean, we worked very closely with the Office of Civil Rights and whose expertise is HIPAA. And we tried to, I mean, like Morris said, there's differences, and we're kind of flipping the script a little bit because as far as information blocking goes, we're working off of everything should be shared unless there's a good reason not to or it's required by law, whereas HIPAA works the other way, limiting the amount that can be released. So we want to work within HIPAA and in a way that's complementary to HIPAA, but it was kind of necessary to lay out, at least in our opinion, necessary to lay out these sub exceptions the way we did.
And this is Anil. Did you guys get a sense from the OCR folks what kind of burden this additional set of tasks might impose on the overall support for HIPAA that most organizations would have to deal with?
So,
like, go ahead.
No, we worked quite a bit with the Office for Civil Rights on this one, and one of the key concepts we wanted to make sure we got correct was it had to be consistent with the privacy rule. In other words, we didn't want a heavy lift for covered entities and business associates who already comply with the privacy rule to do any extra work for not disclosing, right?
The tricky thing was that in cures, it talks about required by law. But with HIPAA, like Morris explained before, there's a lot of times when it's not necessarily required, but a condition needs to be met. So it was kind of a tricky, it could be or it couldn't be. So we had to work that out.
Okay, great.
And in the last, I think D makes perfect sense. Morris, as you explained it, makes actually pretty good sense to me. I like it.
Right. And where we don't have a lot of time for E, you know, having given this some thought, it certainly seems reasonable. I must say it's very, very patient-centric.
Yeah. I was going to say, I quite like it. I understand.
Yeah, I do too.
I'm sure Arian's going to tell us we're wrong when he comes back to our next call. But.
Anil, were you comfortable with this one?
I am, except number two, so such request is initiated by the individual. You know, I think in other places I see individual or a legal designate or something of that sort, like a guardian or someone
well, I think,
else.
I think individual has a definition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure
it,
does.
It,
yeah.
Yep. Then I'm good with this.
Yeah,
cool. It's an actual person one.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, at least I'm not going to forget that one in a time. I can remember doing something similar back in the UK, and we used the term denizen instead of citizen. It caused the same level of discussion.
Okay. Now, what's missing from this one is any reference to the organization having a policy to support this.
I think this goes over and above. I don't think it's been bound in any way, is it? If an individual requests it, it doesn't matter if you've got a policy or not.
Well, that's fair. Right, because again, this is being used essentially as a defense for not releasing. So we didn't release the information because they asked us, and we satisfied all of these conditions. That's fair. We do have a policy for this, which, you know, and I helped to write it, which is why I was thinking about it. But
I think it makes perfect common sense that an organization should have a policy so that they have a defensible position if there's an accusation of information blocking. But this doesn't need to require it because it's kind of an absolute. Irrelevant to whether you have a policy or not. You can be asked.
Yep. Hey guys, I'm really sorry, but I've got a call right now.
No, hey, that's
so
okay,
I'm gonna
guys.
Sell up.
It's the top of
right.
the top
time.
Right, thank you.
Thank you both that are still here. Thank you ever so much for doing this. I appreciate the amount of time it's taking out of your day. Please do continue to comment on the document before the next meeting. Yeah, Anil went through this once already. I think all of us should. And we're going to come back and we'll start actually suggesting some modifications, I think, for the next call as well. We're working pretty quickly through these.
And for those still on, our next call is on Friday at 2:30 Eastern, I believe.
Cool.
Yeah, and I have I'm just going to have to drop a little early on Friday, but I see that that's acceptable because I've got a statewide work group that starts at 4:00 Eastern. So.
Oh, I never said it was acceptable. I just didn't complain when they needed it. of course you can, not a problem at all. I appreciate it.
Very good.
Hey,
all right.
Hey, Andy and Michael, do you have a minute to talk? Thanks, Stephen.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Sure.
Great. While I have you, I just want to, because I was telling Andy earlier, I have to get some slides together for the full task force presentation on Friday at 11, and I have to get them to a cell by 24 hours before by 11 a.m. tomorrow. I was just wondering kind of what you're thinking about putting in there. I guess, Andy, you had mentioned just putting in a slide that says what topics we've discussed for each work group and some of the issues. I think it might be tough at this point to I'm not sure how exactly the best way to flesh out some of the issues that we've talked about. any thoughts would be helpful.
Let's just be absolutely factual and say we got through X rules out of Y, and we're progressing as planned.
So, no, that works for me. What do you want to cover in the discussion then? Do you want to get into substantive topics for each work group, or?
Who's the audience?
It's the full task force, so all three
okay.
work groups. And...
Yeah, I think maybe we should get out on the table the key issues which are arising.
From your perspective, do you want to maybe, would it be possible just to kind of put a few bullets down, of, and I can do the same thing tonight, kind of based on
yeah.
the calls, what you think would
yeah.
be good ones? You know, no, well, I won't
think,
put much detail on the slides. But
work groups three, we should probably put down whistleblower. We should probably get down the intellectual property concerns. We should probably get down alignment of all the actors so that there's a common approach across all actors, even though the penalties are different. I got that from work group three as well as work group one this morning. Those are my big hitters so far.
Okay. If you want, I mean, if you think about it more and you just sometime tonight or in the morning, just send me a couple of bullets. I'll look through the Google Doc and should be able to pull out, you know, the issues as well. But
comment.
And do you guys want to? I think I'm supposed to have you review the slides before I send them. Will you be able, if I send them to you in the morning, would you be able to give them a quick look? I don't think they'll be too.
Yeah, I will. Sure.
Okay.
Oh, my God, you spent doing this for you now, Mark.
We're going to become best buds. You're
going
to have to invite me over the pond or something for a little trip or, you know, who knows.
Well, Mike, are you going to be able to do something? I'm exhausted from today. That's 4 hours of this.
I'm worn out.
Y'all will be okay. Tough enough.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, I'll let you guys go.
Thanks, guys.
But I do appreciate it. It was good conversations. We'll talk tomorrow a lot, I'm sure.
how are the other task force going? Are you involved in any others? Lauren's still on. Lauren, how are the other task force going?
I think that you guys are probably making the best progress so far. I think probably because we have...
It's not a competition, right?
Yeah, not at all.
That's the right answer.
Oh, no, guys, it's totally a competition. Okay. I'm glad we're not behind the others, put it that way. You know, I know we are slightly behind where we wanted to be, but I think we are still... We're getting a lot of conversation, which I'm very pleased about.
Yeah. For sure.
I'm surprised that there's no more public interest.
Well, I think because we just flipped these over to be public meetings yesterday, this morning.
Yeah.
They haven't been public notice for that long, but next week it'll probably be a different story.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Get ready.
Great job, Andy and Mark.
Right. Thanks again.
All right, thanks
guys.
Take care.
Okay.
Talk tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
We'll do. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.